We're going to move the, Josh says that the.
There's a cemetery bill out there, too.
Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Rules to order. Today, we have four items on our agenda. We will start off with Senate Bill 1542, then we'll have Senate Bill 1544, and the third one will be SCR 201, and the fourth one will be SB 1567. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1542. Josh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1542 changes the start date of the odd-numbered year regular sessions of the Legislative Assembly. Under current law, both odd-numbered and even-numbered regular sessions commence on the first day of February unless that date falls on a Thursday through Sunday, in which case the session begins on the following Monday. Senate Bill 1542 retains that start date for even-numbered year regular sessions while commencing odd-numbered year regular sessions on the day after the holiday for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and we have the Honorable Senator Floyd Prusansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Prusansky, State Senator District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for taking up Senate Bill 1542 today. What this bill is actually trying to do is get us, I think, more in sync as to what most members and I think most people who work within the Capitol would appreciate, and that is that our work can be done and we can be back in district. We can participate in district events for 4th of July. As you remember, just in this past session in 2017, our exit date was actually after the 4th of July, so we actually had to come back in and put in additional work, and I think we got out on a Friday around noon for the Senate, and we could have been here, I believe, at least till Saturday, if not on the Sunday. I forget exactly what the day is. As you all know, the long session is limited to 160 days, and there have been multiple discussions as to how we might want to approach this. I think it's important for us to keep in mind as to that the orientation days that are required under the Constitution is not changed under this bill. We would still be required to meet as we do and do the first 3 days of that week during the orientation and having the first readings of our bills for the long session. That would allow for the staff in the building to be able to process that work over the next 2 days of that week, the following week, and then depending on when MLK Day is, it could actually be a little bit longer depending on what year it is. My review of the calendar, I don't believe we would ever be caught up in a leap year issue because of every 4 years is when we have leap year, and it's not any time on an odd number year. At least that's my quick analysis. To give you an example of how this would work, if this bill was passed for 2019, our start date would be Tuesday, January 22nd, because MLK Day is Monday the 21st. I've counted out 160 days, and the end date for that would be June 30th. That would be, in most cases, the latest that we would be here. Now, clearly, there are procedures for us to extend our sessions, which we've never had to do, but if we needed to extend it, it would still come in play where we would be potentially here till the 4th, but I would think that we would, if we had to extend it, we'd be out before that. In the year 2021, our start date would be January 19th. The end date would be June 27th. In 2023, our start date would be January 17th, and then the end date would be June 25th. And then the last one that I went out was for 2025, and that would be a start date of January 21 with the end date of June 29th. So as you can see, all four of those bienniums, we would be out before the 1st of July, which would allow us to be back in our districts. I know that most of us have obligations in district to celebrate and be with constituents during the 4th of July celebrations. I know for myself, with parades and stuff, it's hard to be here and be able to also be there where I think that most of us would like to have that break. I will leave it with the memory that I had when I first was elected in 1994, when I came in 1995. One of the wise counsels I got, because that was the year that we had the shortest session on record, recent times, I should say, and that was when Gordon Smith was the president of the Senate. He wanted to be back for pea picking season, and we were out in like the second week of June. And I thought, well, this is great. But then someone reminded me or told me, says, this was unique. This is different. Which, and of course, if you remember, we did not have time limits as to how long our sessions could go. And they said, what you never want to do is to have the assembly needing to be here on or after the 4th of July, because everyone gets grumpy. So hopefully this will be keeping people from getting grumpy, and we'll have everyone out, and they can be back in their districts for the events of July 4th, and actually be able to spend it in district with their families and their constituents.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski, knowing a little bit about how you attend the 4th of July parades, I'm a little surprised how eager you are to get there, but commend you for for your diligence.
Well, you know, there's certain things that you learn on the job, and in Salem, I've learned how to be a pooper scooper. So
that's what he does with the 4th of July parades.
I usually have, like at the Yonkala Parade, it's anywhere from 35 to 53 horses that are in front of me, and I do have my work cut out for me. Big shovel.
Thank you very much. Are there questions to Senator Roblin?
I do appreciate the fact that you chose my sister's birthday for the beginning of this experiment.
Yes. So, and then one thing I will just want to comment on, I know that there were multiple reasons why we were starting later. At one point, it had been discussed that we needed to have that May forecast. I will say that I think experience has shown that we've been able, with the May forecast date, still to be out in many cases at the end of June. Are very closely after the end of June. And also, I think, for the front end, to ensure that first readings can occur. That happens during orientation day, and I believe staff would have enough time to make those assignments so we could actually come in on a earlier basis than we do now and be able to get to work.
Great. And some of us remember the infamous August adjournment day.
Two of them.
Yes.
03 and 05.
I don't think we talk about those.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
I just wanted to note that, as Senator Brzezinski pointed out, there are multiple reasons why we started later, and all of them are bad. So we should do this.
The pea-picking caucus has spoken. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have no other witnesses signed up. Is there anyone else who wanted to talk?
Madam Chair, there's not some lobbyist that wants to stay here till the 4th of July?
Maybe he's pooper scooping.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1542 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1544.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1544 is a relating to marijuana bill. There are six amendments posted on the list, additional amendments forthcoming, and my understanding is the panel would like to talk to you about the process.
Yes, we have a panel headed by Senator Brzezinski with Whitney Perez and Rob Bovet. That's it. Right.
Okay. Again, thank you very much, Chair Burdick and committee members. Again, Floyd Przonski, State Senator District 4. With me is Whitney Perez, who is one of our legal counsels for judiciary, as well as the esteemed counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, Rob Levette. And I've asked for both of them to come up before they can be a dual lifeline for me, because there's been a lot of activity as to what we're attempting to do with 1544. I will just open up that the basis and premise for Senate Bill 1544 is a continuation of trying to move forward on multiple pieces of legislation that we've had before this assembly, dealing with both industrial hemp on a sidetrack, but also dealing with the cannabis as it pertains to the medical as well as the recreational. We have heard from numerous individuals, or I should say I've heard from numerous individuals, as to some additional changes that they feel are necessary to ensure the protections of the program, the efficiency of the programs. And with that, there are a number of amendments that have been worked on, and I can assure the committee that work is not completed, and we'll continue to be working on it. And so, with your indulgence, I'd like to allow for the two councils to kind of give a roadmap of where we're at now and hopefully how we can move forward.
Excellent. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. Before I start describing the nine amendments, and I'll be brief. Let me state kind of where we're at here today, especially for the members of the committee other than Senator Burdick and Beyer, who were on the Joint Marijuana Committee for 3 years with us. The roadmap of marijuana regulation by states changed pretty dramatically last month. The Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, revoked what are called the Cole memos. That was the framework upon which we crafted statutes in about 28 states. That framework was removed, which meant that in each district, the United States Attorney kind of controls the show. In our district, the District of Oregon, United States Attorney Billy Williams really has echoed the same concerns we heard from the Cole memo, which is reassuring to us who've been crafting the statutes. His concerns are the same concerns, basically, that were in the Cole memo. Things like diversion, overproduction, plant counts, things like that that he has expressed concern about. So he's a career prosecutor, and I'm glad to see his appointment moving forward in the U.S. Senate, because he's not looking to do something counter to the industry. He just wants to essentially hold us accountable and make sure we're dealing with these problems. So that's the background. And let me talk about this bill in particular, pieces of which are attempted to be responsive to the concerns that we heard from U.S. Attorney Williams at a recently held summit at the United States Courthouse in Portland. That he had. I know some of your staff and some of you were there as well. And so we discussed some of those concerns, and some of the proposed amendments are designed to address those. So I'll just go through them in order. I'll take dash 3 and dash 4 real quickly, because most of the folks that I've talked to don't understand them. I'm not sure who these are from. These deal with immature plants on the medical marijuana side. One involves including cuttings within the definition of immature plants, and the other one deals with OLCC retailer shops' ability to sell maximum count immature plants. I suspect I might know the purpose of these, but I'm not sure, and I'm happy to work with the proponents of these amendments if they can be identified to maybe get them closer to what they want to accomplish. The Dash 7 amendments, you'll hear more, I think, on these from Christine from the Sungrown Guild. Are amendments that are designed to clarify, at least as I understand them, that just because a medical marijuana grower has more than 12 plants and is therefore in the metric seed-to-sale tracking system, that they should not thereby be deemed for local time, place, and manner regulations or other purposes to be commercial. The problem is, I think the Dash 7 amendments don't really do that. I'm not really sure they do anything. So I think I'm going to work with Christine and the Guild to maybe craft something that actually does what they want to accomplish in those Dash 7s. The Dash 9 amendments, Mr. Winkles from League of Oregon Cities can talk more about that. It's just a clarification to make sure that cities and counties can actually deposit their tax revenues from marijuana taxes into their budget and show those without inadvertently violating Department of Revenue statutes that make taxpayer confidentiality when you only got one or two shops in your city. But Mr. Winkles will talk more about that. The Dash 10 amendments are basically the second half of House Bill 4011, which I suspect is not going to be moving forward. I think it's the non-controversial part of House Bill 4011, and what they do is they require that OLCC licensed shops separately label and display products sold in their shops that are derived from industrial hemp rather than marijuana. You'll hear probably more about that from Nikki from OCBC. Dash 11 amendments is the third rewrite of the base bill you have in front of you. It's really close. We've just got a couple of more tweaks that I think Anthony Taylor from Compassionate Oregon is going to talk to you about, and working with him on crafting those additional tweaks to that amendment. There are three more amendments in process I'll just mention briefly. There is a proposal to directly address Billy Williams' concern about the lack of enforcement, particularly in Southern Oregon, against the black market, true black market operators. And so we have a proposal that we're working on crafting, modeled on a recently enacted Colorado piece of legislation addressing this exact same problem in exactly the same way we're proposing, which is to continue what we call the skim off the top of marijuana taxes and redirect some of that, which was redirected to OLCC while they were doing the ramp up of regulations, and redirect that to the Criminal Justice Commission to grant out to communities to directly go after the black market.
And Rob, which amendment is that?
Don't have a dash yet. Still in process. There's another one in process as well, dealing with making it clear that high THC industrial hemp products can only be sold through licensed OLCC retail shops. I think we may craft that one, but it sounds like we're not going to have to present that to you because the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 4089 were just introduced about half an hour ago, and I think it's going to take care of that problem in the industrial hemp bill itself. And then finally, we're going to need a new amendment. I know this is really going to be painful to Senators Burdick and Beyer, but this will be the sixth attempt to really deal with how we go about permitting OLCC-licensed retail shops that are less than 1,000 feet but more than 500 feet from a school. I know, it's painful. But this is a real...
You add me to that mix.
This is a real surgical amendment, and it only results because we used to have cities and counties make the determination whether that was allowable, and it's only allowable if you've got an intervening geographical object, such as a freeway or a river, right? So we used to have cities and counties make that determination, and now we have OLCC make that determination. And so we just need a grandfather that says if the city or county made that determination, then it just rolls forward into OLCC. So it's the sixth time we're going to get it right, I promise, and we'll get that squared away. So that's, I think, what's on the table before you. It's a work in progress, and hopefully we'll maybe be able to package all of this stuff up into a single dash. It'll probably be 23 or something, and present it to you in a way that most, if not all, stakeholders are happy with.
Thank you. That last one would be known as the Senator Pozanski Holy Grail Amendment.
Yeah, it has been.
Did you want to testify?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I think that did a pretty good job of summarizing the amendments. For the most part, Whitney Perez, for the record, P-E-R-E-Z. I spend the bulk of my time working on the Dash 7 and mostly the Dash 11 amendment. I suppose I'll touch on the Dash 3 and 4. Those were a request made by a constituent, and I think part of what they are is also dependent on what ultimately ends up in 1544. When you look at the introduced version of the bill, there is a language eliminating the distinction of 24 inches or higher. And so the constituent's email, I think, was concerned about that elimination of the distinction and also creating limitations on immature plants regardless of height, and so affecting seedlings or trimmings, and if those would then fall into a definition of immature plant and what those limits would be. So I think that's the request you see. I believe that's in the Dash 3, whether the requesting that the definition of immature plants be changed. And so again, I think those constituents' concerns might be alleviated depending on what ultimately ends up in 1544. For instance, with the Dash 11, that's restored where there's a distinction on the 24 inches or higher immature plant limitations, and then delegating to rulemaking for OHA on the under 24 inches. And the other concern, which again, that the constituent raised that might be impacted about in the final version of the bill, is being able for those OLCC recreational stores, if you will, forgetting the proper term, that also sell medical marijuana products to be able to sell seedlings to medical marijuana patients or cardholders. And so that's what that amendment is attempting to reach. And I think it also relates to the concerns about possible limitations on immature plants and how that might affect the ability of patients to obtain seedlings.
Thank you. Do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, the only thing I guess I would say is that there's been a work group that's been meeting prior to the session starting. This is kind of the culmination of getting all of those elements together. And as both councils have said, there's going to be some additional work. Our goal is to get this as succinct as we can before time runs out. And there's also, in some cases, we've realized that the commission or the committee that's being formed from previous legislation will be taking up some of the issues that have been brought to us that we've decided that at this point is too big of a lift, or it should be actually delegated to the committee that we have established, because they'll have the bandwidth to actually put more time into it than what we will.
Which committee are you referring to?
The
Oregon Cannabis Commission.
The Oregon Cannabis Commission.
Correct.
I said committee.
Okay.
Commission.
Yeah. Okay.
Apologize.
Thank
Don't
you.
Give me
thank you for that. I think in terms of direction, given that this is a short session, the technical changes are going to be important, and yes, the distance from the school issue is important, and it would be nice to dispense with that. When it comes to expanding the number of plants of any sort, I would want to hold off on that until we have more experience with the limits that we have now. So I'm just trying to help by sending some direction into how I'd like to see the amendments come forward. This is a complicated bill, and I want to welcome Senator Winters and Senator Roblin and Senator Boquist to the world of marijuana. You now know what we were doing for 3 years on the joint
committee. Not yet, they don't.
Not yet.
I don't think you want my experience in this particular one. So.
I'll just leave that one alone. But thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you for all your
thank
work
you.
On this. Okay, our next panel will be Scott Winkles, Casey Houlihan, and Nikki Terziev.
Chair Burdick, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'll be speaking to the Dash 9 amendments. The Dash 9 amendments are what I would characterize as sort of a growing pain in our regulated market issues. The challenge for us is that because the local marijuana tax, cities and counties are each allowed to impose a 3% sales tax that's typically collected by Department of Revenue. Not all cities have intergovernmental agreements with Department of Revenue, but most do. The issue is if those cities have, say, one to four shops, it's problematic for them to list that revenue on their budget, in their budget documents, because money collected by Department of Revenue is not releasable as confidential data. But the city must comply with budget law, which says you must, which requires us to list sources of revenue. So essentially what's the Dash 9s would do is say, allow these cities to say, as a line item on their budget, marijuana tax revenue. It's an interesting point of law, because right now if you have a finance director or a city recorder or some other city professional staff that is complying with budget law, under a very technical reading, they've actually committed a felony. That seems to be a conflict that we would like to correct. So, for instance, Depot Bay, I believe they have three marijuana shops. They would have to find some way to list that money as something other than what it is, which isn't transparent. It's problematic for the city. It creates political issues, some tensions, and so we would suggest that we just simply be able to say, this is how much money we've gotten from the city's. This is how much money they've gotten on a budget document.
Thank you. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. We are an Oregon-based small business trade association that is happy to be in front of some new, fresh faces to talk about cannabis and marijuana. As you heard from the Chair Burdick, we have put in a lot of work over the many years that this issue has been before the legislature. We're now in a place where we can do some fine-tuning. It's very exciting. Our members, the anywhere between 70 and 100, depending on the licensing cycle, our members are very excited to be able to tackle some of the minutia in policy now. The Dash 10s would be our minutia of choice for this particular session. We want to talk about customer clarity and patient protection. Regardless of which side of this issue you are on, whether you are pro or whether you are against, what we know is important and the value we share is clarity for the consumer. We have hemp-derived CBD products, and we have cannabis-derived CBD products. This is a chemical that doesn't participate and doesn't act in the same way depending on its source material, where it was sourced from. And so we want to be sure that when somebody walks into an OLCC licensed retail shop, they can look at the shelf and they can determine which is the product they're after. Do they want the CBD from cannabis or do they want the CBD from hemp? There's going to be enough clarity in packaging, labeling. We would look to the agency to apply similar rules that they've already created for like products, and we're hoping that will be fairly easy for them to reproduce. And that way you or anyone you love can walk into a retailer and determine what is the best course for them.
Thank you. Casey.
Yes. Casey Houlihan, I'm the executive director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association. We're a trade association that represents over 250 cannabis businesses across the state, predominantly retailers, but we also have producers, processors, distributors, as well as ancillary businesses. We are largely in support of the concepts that we've seen throughout the amendments to this bill. Specifically, we wanted to also echo some support for the additional amendment to come that Rob Bovet mentioned regarding retailers and the 500 but less than 1,000 feet from a school, and making sure that those folks are not forced out. Several of the members of our group, a couple of our members of group, have hit some renewal hurdles regarding the OLCC taking control of that particular approval mechanism, even though these are folks that have already had the city or county that they're located in approve of their location in particular. Otherwise, we think that this is a common sense package of technical fixes that we're broadly in support of, and we don't think that increasing the permissions of medical patients to grow additional plants or anything else like that will really have a significant impact on the retail economy that we are seeing grow month after month. And we're happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you. I'll talk to you more offline on some of the technicalities of the reporting the income.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Final panel, Leland Berger, Christine Evert, and Anthony Taylor.
Why don't you go ahead, or Anthony?
Anthony's not bashful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony on this bill today. So nice to be before you again, Senator Burdick, and Senator Byers. It's been an interesting journey. We're happy with the direction this bill is headed and with the amendments that have been discussed coming forward. There is one thing I did want to mention. It's a technical thing where we have one issue that contradicts another one, but we'll work that out in the amendment. And other than that, I like the direction the bill is going, and look forward to the final amendments. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christine Everts, representing the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. The Oregon Sun Growers Guild is the largest cannabis trade association representing both sun growers and OMMP patients. Our mission is to advocate for and promote sustainable sun-grown cannabis, family farms, and conscientious consumers. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 1544, which really is an extension of the legislation that was passed last session. It's good to see two members of the former joint committee here and have your institutional knowledge. And and I also, of course, really appreciate the work of Senator Przanski in bringing this legislation forward. This is the product of several work group meetings in the interim to really address the medical cannabis program fixes that we needed. And I think we've come to some good agreement on the best language here. I would say perhaps the most significant policy change last session was to move all medical growers into the seed-to-sale tracking system through OLCC. And recognizing that this was a costly and cumbersome mandate, the committee was careful to exempt small mom and and pop growers who are two patients at a residence growing for themselves. A bright line was drawn at 12 plants so that these patients could continue to grow their six plants each without triggering that mandate. However, due to the wording of the bill during implementation, this 12-plant limit, or what became known as the 12-plant rule, was being interpreted by the agency to apply to designated growers who were registered with OHA to grow for multiple patients. And so many who were registered to legally grow 24, 48 plants were then being told that because of their status as patients growing for themselves at their residence, they would need to reduce to 12 plants. As you can imagine, this sent shockwaves through the community and resulted in a great deal of confusion. So there's language in Senate Bill 1544 in Section 4 of the Dash 11 amendments, as well as the original bill, aimed at clarifying who that 12-plant rule applies to. The other policy change was to limit immature plants over 24 inches in height to two immature for every one. And, of course, need to remind folks that these are non-flowering, non-psychoactive plants. So in layman's terms, they don't get you high. But the intent to place boundaries around immature plants really came from concerns about diversion. And we certainly recognize that. However, we believe that having all of these plants tracked in metric addresses that concern. And we should treat medical immature plants and recreational immature plants with parity, increasing the ratio to at least 4-to-1, or directing OHA through rule to determine those limits are solid approaches that we see in the Dash 11 amendments and would support. We support the processing fix in the original bill and the Dash 11 amendments, provided that designated growers are included. And finally, we know that with all the realignment that's happening in the medical program due to growers leaving the system either to become OLCC licensed or those who are reducing to 12 plants to opt out of the tracking mandate, that patients are losing their access to medicine. And moving the number of plants, or excuse me, the number of patients that a grower can have from 4-to-8 allows the growers remaining in OMMP to accept more patients. It also helps streamline the program, making it easier for OLCC tracking to absorb those new growers. And that will be quite an influx of medical growers to the system. We want to ensure that as the migration to recreational cannabis continues, patients' needs can be met, and those opting to remain growers in the medical program can move forward with more certainty and have more streamlined regulatory system in which to function. The Sun Growers Guild encourages your support for the Dash 11 amendments, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name's Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer, and I am the chair of the Oregon Normal Legislative Committee. And I've been coming to the legislature on cannabis-related issues since the 1999 session and practicing law since 1983. I was aware of this 12-plant issue, and I know that Mr. Taylor has been working hard on this bill and hadn't planned, frankly, on coming down. But in reviewing the text of the bill and having attended the summit at the that the U.S. attorney put on, I did have some suggestions. And I heard what you said, Chair Burdick, about where we are in the process. And I understand that it might not happen this session, but I drove down here and I want to tell you about it anyway so that you at least have some thought about it. The first really is something that I've been doing in my practice. At page 3, section 3, line 21, it describes processors processing for patients and their providers for a fee. And I had testified at the rulemaking before the OLCC that we ought to insert the word waivable. I think ultimately we're going to wind up with mostly indigent patients as we work through this transition. And I've been encouraging my, I've been encouraging my clients to have, my processor clients to have one day a month where they process for free for patients. And I think writing that into the law would be helpful. Concerning diversion, the problem with diversion, of course, is fundamentally that there's federal prohibition and an insufficient market. And one effort to try and expand the market last session was a bill that Senator Przanski had that would have authorized Governor Brown to enter into compacts with California and Washington the way she has with the Confederated Warm Springs tribes to allow free trade and to expand the Oregon market. You might consider including that bill in this. It passed out of the Senate Judiciary but didn't get to a floor vote in the Senate last session. I think a lot of the changes in the medical program, which were in defiance of the will of the people in Measure 91, where they said to not change the program at all, have forced some growers into the underground, or what I like to call the traditional market. And the solution last session was to allow 20 pounds to be transferred into OLCC-regulated retail or processors. We spoke about this at our meeting last night, the Oregon Normal Legislative Committee. We think that should be increased from 20 pounds over a 12-month period to 20 pounds a month and 140 pounds total. And then the last thing is that we think that there is excess from some of the homegrown plants. That's also a diversion issue, although more locally than out of state. And if a person is a good home grower and has more cannabis than they're allowed to possess or that they can use or share, they also ought to be allowed to sell that into the OLCC system. So those are the suggestions I have for addressing the federal concerns on these issues, and I appreciate your having listened to what I have to say. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Christine, you mentioned the 12-plant limit and people being forced to reduce, people who were growing for others being forced to reduce to 12. Isn't the intention to have, once you get past 12, you have to do the seed-to-sale regulation? Can you describe to me what you're asking for here?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the question. And what this is seeking is really clarification in statute, so that those growers who are already above 12 plants and certainly planning on being in tracking and continuing to grow for those patients don't have any confusion in the way that this is implemented. I'm aware that last fall, OHA worked with patients and growers to find a workaround and a waiver in order to deal with this. And so many growers did have to restructure their gardens, designating, if they were patients growing for themselves, designated others to grow for them. And so this is really kind of a restructuring on paper to accommodate that. We do feel that having this clarified in statute would be valuable moving forward.
Okay, does this have to do with the ability to inspect? Is this because it's at the person's house? I guess I'm trying to understand what the problem is here. Why people were forced to get down to 12?
Chair Burdick, it was really a function of the agency interpreting the word of the law and seeing that because the patient had a status of, or because the grower had a status of being a patient growing for themselves at their residence, that was triggering the 12-plant limit. And so that's the 12-plant rule that we're hoping to clarify. It would have no impact on inspections. It would have no impact on who needs to move into tracking. It would simply just clarify that the growers that are growing for multiple patients at 24 or 48 plants would not need to reduce down to 12.
Okay, got it. I think I understood that. Thanks.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is a result of the interpretation, as Christine alluded to, by the agency, and it really was an interpretation of what we adopted in 2198 as a result of allowing both husband and wife to grow their 6 plants. And the interpretation was that if that was the case, we actually put a section in there that allowed if there was a patient and non-patient growing together, they could grow their 6 and 10. But the interpretation of this particular section resulted in many of the grow sites having to restructure their grow site, as Christine alluded to. And this is a clarification to make sure that we address the issue of the 12-plant grows Originally was to address the issue of them growing their four extra plants, their four recreational plants. So we went from, so we had a situation in residential zoning and city limits where a person could grow 16 plants because of the residential, or I'm sorry, because of the four personal plants. And so this is a clarification on that to make it so that patients growing for themselves at their own property can continue as allowed by statute to grow for others.
All right, Senator Bocas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question to counsel here. I think I hear what you're saying in terms of the expansion and allowing processing. Is that really a result of the U.S. Attorney's Office, your recommendation result of the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that, you know, if you don't start addressing these issues, that they're going to intervene?
No, Senator Burdick and Senator Boquist, the recommendation about them being able to process for a waivable fee is compassionate, addressing the fact that increasingly patients with funds can buy at the store tax-free, but patients without funds who are growing for themselves, who take their excess to a processor to be processed, are indigent, and if processors can waive the fee, that would be a good thing. It isn't, Oregon Normal generally as a consumer's lobby is concerned with all consumers, with medical consumers and with healthy adults. But in Oregon, post the last 3 years of the changes in the medical law, again, the way I see it, you know, we've reduced from 75,000 to 50,000 patients statewide, and I think ultimately we're going to wind up with a pool of mostly indigent patients. And working with a group called Voter Power in 2003 and 2010, we tried to craft initiatives that we got on the ballot that lost, but that addressed the issue of supplying indigent patients. And so this minor tweak, the waivable fee, you know, the is an attempt to help the industry be compassionate and provide some legislative direction towards being compassionate to indigent patients. It's unrelated to the diversion issue. The other suggestions relate to the diversion issue, allowing more medical marijuana to come into the OLC system, allowing homegrown marijuana to come into the OLC system, and allowing the governor to enter into compacts with Washington and Oregon. Those all expand and direct, the first two direct product into the system so it takes it out of the underground or traditional market. And the other one, the compact idea, expands the market. Further expansion, I think, would require congressional approval. The day after the 2018 election, I had a letter to the editor published in the Oregonian encouraging Congress to allow free trade between the now four coterminous Western states, Washington, Oregon, California, and Nevada. So that's not something the Oregon legislature can do, but the Oregon legislature can allow the governor to enter into compacts with Washington and California, similar to the way it has with the Warm Springs tribe. And that's, as I mentioned, I don't know the number, but Senator Pozanski would. It was a bill that passed out of Senate Judiciary last year, but didn't make it to the Senate floor.
So in terms of the poundage issue, this is the poundage issue of, 20 pounds to 20 pounds per month. There's quite a considerable amount of hype of the position of the nominee for the deputy U.S. attorney in Oregon, and he's not known to be patient in any means whatsoever. And so while I heard what the chair said in terms of addressing volume issues, 10 months from now, my question is what was your interpretation, since you were there with Mr. Williams, of his level of patience and their level of emphasis? I've heard from other members that they are prepared to act swiftly. I've heard other members that they are posturing, and of course he's not the appointee yet. So, I mean, you were there. I mean, in some of you, maybe three of you, were there. I mean, what sort is the characterization of the representation of the federal government at this meeting?
Oh, Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, I've known Mr. Williams for three decades, and there were a couple of things that came out of the meeting that were pretty clear. Governor Brown testified. Mr. Williams spoke, and then Governor Brown spoke, and she said that Mr. Williams had assured her that industry-licensed businesses that were in compliance with state law are not targets of federal intervention. So that's the first thing that was a takeaway. A second thing that was a takeaway for me from the meeting, and Mr. Taylor was there anyway, so he may have different ideas, is that, and as Mr. Bovette has mentioned, there's a concern about what's going on in Southern Oregon in terms of the amount of law enforcement, and historically, the federal government has backed up local law enforcement in areas where there weren't enough resources. And Mr. Williams described attending meetings in Medford, and I expect that we'll see more federal intervention in unregulated diversion, people that didn't opt into medical, didn't opt into adult use, that are just growing and distributing. I think that they're going to become more targets of the federal government. That was the sense I got about that. It's important to remember also, I think, that the Cole memo was a recommendation to prosecutors about how to exercise their discretion in enforcing the Controlled Substances Act in states that had legalized medical or adult use. It's important to remember also that the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, that's now the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment, defunds the Department of Justice from enforcing the law as to states where the laws are implementing medical, and there's a cogent argument to be made that I've made and that in conversations with Mr. Marks, he's agreed that all of Oregon laws are implementing the medical program because of the way it's been folded together. And every U.S. attorney, and I've spoken with each of them since we passed the medical, from Chris Olson in 98 through Bill Williams, seems to agree that if you're in compliance with state law and they're not otherwise interested in you, they're not interested in enforcing the Controlled Substances Act. So I think that policy is going to continue, notwithstanding what's going on in D.C. Now, things in D.C., as you know, are quite volatile. It's uncertain even how long the current Attorney General is going to remain the current Attorney General. He spoke yesterday about how he is insistent on enforcing the federal law, but the fact is that the local U.S. attorneys have tremendous discretion, and the way they've been exercising it and what they've been saying and what Mr. Williams has been saying is consistent with what I've seen from the federal government locally over the last 20 years.
All right.
I hope that answers your questions,
and
I'd be glad to speak with you further about it.
No, I simply have to convey to my colleagues in order to calm down.
Thank you.
Senator Winter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I don't believe he's confirmed yet, is he?
I couldn't hear what you said.
Williams, I don't believe that he's confirmed yet.
I think Chair Burdick, Senator Winters, I think that's correct. And you heard Mr. Bovette say that he was looking forward to his advancing through the Senate. I don't think there's any likelihood that he's not going to be confirmed. Oh. and we've had acting U.S. attorneys continue as acting U.S. attorneys for a long period of time before.
Madam Chair, isn't another one of the issues here, and it was just briefly said earlier about the cartels, and not only about the grow, but what's going out of Oregon?
I'm sorry, Senator Winters.
What's going out of Oregon? That's the concern.
The concern is what's leaving Oregon, and it's leaving Oregon because it's illegal federally, and it's illegal elsewhere, and it commands a higher price. If we want to end diversion, we need to end federal prohibition.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Burke. It's a pleasure seeing you.
Okay, now our final witness is Courtney Moran.
That's the most cogent.
Session.
Hi, this is Jenny Burdick. I'm chair of the Senate Rules Committee, and I'm joined by Vice Chair Senator Winters and the other members of the committee. And we're looking forward to your testimony on Senate Bill 1544.
Excellent. Thank you so much for calling.
If you could,
may I begin my testimony?
Yes, please identify yourself and your organization.
Thank you. I am Courtney Moran, and I am a cannabis attorney with my firm Earth Law LLC, and I'm also the lobbyist for the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association, which is an Oregon nonprofit collective of registered farmers and handlers within the state of Oregon and part of the Oregon Department of Agriculture Hemp Program. We are opposed to the Dash 10 amendments in its current form. This amendment is unnecessary and provides overly broad authority for rulemaking to the OLCC. Industrial hemp products that are entering in licensed OLCC retail dispensaries already require the same testing, meeting the same testing requirements as marijuana products, and must also meet the labeling and packaging pre-approval require and other requirements established by OLCC. Currently, we are working with OLCC and have been working as well with the Department of Justice on clear additional rulemaking authority on industrial hemp products that are in OLCC licensed dispensaries and on licensed premises in our industrial hemp bill, HB 4089. In addition, why would we be creating additional regulatory and bureaucratic requirements for retailers dictating where the retailers must put their products in their dispensaries and how they must be displayed? If the committee wanted to see something like this, especially with this new labeling requirement that's being proposed, then this would only make sense if the industrial hemp products did not have to comply with the same testing, labeling, and packaging requirements as OLCC rules, but would be only required to comply with the ODA testing and other rules as required by our ODA program. You know, as an association, we absolutely support and advocate consumer safety and consumer protection. And in fact, we were the association that lobbied and passed the first laws establishing mandatory testing for industrial hemp products. And that applies not only to products entering the OLCC retail market, but into the general consumer marketplace as well. Therefore, we feel that the Dash 10 at this time is not necessary, and we oppose this amendment. We oppose this proposed amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. And please, if you could, if you haven't already, if you could provide your written testimony to our committee staff so that we'll have it on our record.
Excellent. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. And now I'll open it for questions from the committee. I see no questions, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our witness list, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1544 and open a public hearing on SCR 201.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SCR 201 recognizes the recipients of the Oregon Commission for Women's 2017 Women of Achievement Award. SCR 201 has no expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
Okay.
Move it.
We have one witness, I understand. You know who you are. Please come to the podium. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Winters, Senator Beyer, Senator Boquist, and Roblin. For the record, I'm Dr. Adrienne Oakes, member of the Oregon Commission for Women. The Oregon Commission for Women supports Senate Concurrent Resolution 201 in recognizing the 2017 Oregon Women of Achievement for outstanding leadership and service to the people of Oregon. This resolution honors four remarkable women for their accomplishments: Dr. Erlinda Gonzalez-Berry, Dr. Guadalupe Guajardo, Liliana Luna, and Anita Yap. These 2017 Women of Achievement honorees are powerful women who've worked long and hard to make a difference in their respective fields. Each of their own unique way, they represent the values of inclusion, determination, integrity, and generosity. As you know, the Oregon Commission for Women was legislatively established in 1983 to work on women's equality. The commission does this by advocating for women in the community, researching and providing information on women's issues to the governor and state legislature, and serving as a link for women to state agencies and highlighting women's accomplishments in the state of Oregon. As a part of its charter, each year, the Oregon Commission for Women recognizes a group of outstanding Oregon women who've not only made an impact on the lives of women, but who have also left their mark in their respective communities and fields. The 2017 awardees join an elite group of almost 100 women who, since 1985, have received this honor. The Oregon Commission for Women applauds these women and the achievements that they've made to the state of Oregon. Each has worked to ensure justice and equity within this state. We commissioners believe that their achievements warrant special recognition by the state legislature, and we thank the Senate Rules Committee for their review and consideration of this resolution.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions from the committee? I think this bill has a really good chance of passage. Senator Winters and I agree on that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so
and
much.
And for the record, can you confirm that you did receive the bio on each of the four nominees and recipients?
Do we have that on?
Do we have all four
of them? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know about a bio. The resolution itself describes some of their work, and
yes,
I have seen the press release that the commission issued.
Thank you. That's sufficient.
Yes, and if you want to provide more, we'll keep our record open, so feel free.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I will close the public hearing on SCR 201, and we don't have our paperwork on this yet, so we will obtain that and take it up later. So now I will open a public hearing on SB 1567. Josh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1567 requires major political parties to hold a primary election to nominate a candidate to fill the remaining term of a statewide office or the office of a state senator when the vacancy occurs on or before the 70th day before the primary election that precedes the first general election occurring during the vacant term of office. If the vacancy occurs after the 70th day before the primary election but before the 61st day before the general election, Senate Bill 1567 requires the parties to select a nominee by party rule. Senate Bill 1567 has an indeterminate fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you. We have Ed Jorgensen, I think, and Steve Trout.
Guessing the IPO guy won it as well.
Oh, it is? Okay. You just got the paperwork.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Yeah, for the record, my name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm the Assistant Deputy Director of Elections for the State of Oregon. First of all, I want to start off by mentioning that the Secretary is very grateful and applauds the work that's been done to quickly, in a very bipartisan way, move this bill through. And we feel, and he feels, that it helps really improve election laws and also to empower citizens of Oregon. Senate Bill 1567, when there's a vacancy that occurs in the Senate on or before the 70th day before an election, it allows the voters of the major political parties to vote and decide who they want to represent them in the general election of that year. It's a pretty straightforward bill. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer this time.
Thank you. Mr. Trump.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Mr. Jorgensen said, very very simple process. Steve Trout, State Election Director, thank you. Really just trying to make this match the normal process for vacancies so that if there is a an opportunity for the office to appear on a primary election, that it will appear on the primary election.
Some of us were surprised to find that it was not already the case.
Already done.
Questions from the committee. Senator Boquist?
No, I think there might be another person that wants to testify.
Is there another person?
Yes. Okay. The questions for this one first.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next witness, Dan Meek from the Independent Party of Oregon.
Do they mean U.S. Senator or State Senator?
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Meek. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Independent Party of Oregon, Oregon's third major party with 120,000 members. I'm here to oppose this bill because the Oregon primary election process just doesn't work for the Independent Party under existing law. It doesn't work well at all. And what this would do is really eliminate the opportunity for the Independent Party to provide additional voices, additional choices for voters in November. The way the current primary system works is that nobody is
allowed. Step back from the mic. It's very
pardon me,
sensitive.
A little bit. Okay.
Yeah.
Nobody is allowed to be on the Independent Party of Oregon ballot under existing law who has not been a member of the party for 250 days continuously before the primary election. That means the previous September. Now, while this rule might work perfectly well for the Democrats and Republicans who have lifelong members and a deep bench of folks lined up to run for office, it doesn't work for the Independent Party because it requires someone who is going to take the rebellious step of running as a third-party candidate to make that decision more than 14 months in advance of the election. And that just doesn't happen. We have several people in this cycle and in previous cycles who call us up and say, I want to run for an office. I want to run for the legislature in particular. And our first question is, well, have you been a member of the party since last September? And the answer is almost always no. These folks don't think 14 months in advance about running for election. And so they're disqualified. They cannot appear on the primary ballot. The result of this is that our primary ballot, particularly for legislative offices, is almost entirely blank. So, who wins the IPO nominations? Well, it's the incumbent Democrat or the incumbent Republican, because all of those all those nominations are then won by write-in. And the party membership duration requirement does not apply at all to write-in candidates. I suspect that some of you folks on the dais here have won the IPO nomination by write-in in the 2016 primary election. This is incredibly unfair, also because the only people running for the legislative office who get a page in the voter's pamphlet are the Democratic and Republican candidates. We had folks in the 2016 primary election out there, IPO members, not for 250 days, but nevertheless, IPO members who are out trying to win nominations by write-in, and they can't be in the voter's pamphlet. So if you're an IPO voter or an NAV who receives an IPO ballot, you look at your ballot for state senate, and it's blank. What am I going to do? I have to write in somebody. I'll go look at the voter's pamphlet. You look in the voter's pamphlet, what's there for your district? Only the Republican or only the Democrat, and in many cases, only one of them. Only a Democrat or only a Republican is all that you find in the voter's pamphlet for that office for your district. So this is an incredibly unfair system. I believe it violates both the free speech and free association rights of the members of the Independent Party and prospective candidates of the Independent Party. The result is that almost all Independent Party nominations for the legislature amount to are the Democrat or Republican running for the same office. Totally defeats the purpose of the party in offering more voices and more choices. So what would this bill before you do today? Well, it simply reimposes that system when it comes to vacancies. Not a big deal. I mean, there aren't that many vacancies to fill, but still, it expands the application of a bad system that I believe is unconstitutional and that we will be challenging in court.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Boquist.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand here. So, Mr. Meek, the statute is trying to, you're making the connection between the main statute and the replacement statute. This statute, this change, in my understanding, would apply if an IPO candidate had been elected to a position. This is in the replacement of that elected IPO candidate.
It's all, Senator Boquist is in the replacement of any vacancy. So, for example, let's say a Republican resigns, and some of them have. And I believe some Democrats will resign as well, or have resigned in the case of Senator Devlin, creates a vacancy. Under existing law, the IPO can choose not to nominate a candidate by means of primary, but to instead nominate a candidate using internal party rules. That's what IPO would prefer to do, because the primary system under existing law, frankly, our primary nominations are hijacked by the Republicans and the Democrats under existing law. We can't compete. We're not in the voters' pamphlet. We can't put people on the ballot who are our members and who do want to run. So the Democrats and Republicans win our nominations. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that for any candidate, and we don't want to do that in the case of a vacancy.
If you're qualified as a major party, but you can't be in the voters' pamphlet, you're saying?
Write-in candidate, Senator Boquist, our write-in candidates, that is, write-in candidates who are members of the IPO, although not for 250 days before the primary, because otherwise they could be on our ballot. But as I said, most people who want to run for the state legislative office in particular, who come to us and say we want to run, they haven't been members of IPO for 250 days, so they can't be on the ballot. They can only win by write-in, and they can't be in the voters' pamphlet. In contrast, if you're running for the IPO nomination by write-in, you're in the voters' pamphlet. And that seems to me that's the government putting a very heavy thumb, a demonstrably decisive thumb, on the scales.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, that's our witness list, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1567. And I was remiss earlier that we didn't have the paperwork on SCR 201. We actually do, so I am going to open a work session on SCR 201. Senator Winters, do you have a motion?
I move that we move SCR 201 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Winters has moved SCR 201 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Is it be adopted or due pass?
Any objections? So ordered. And with the consent of the committee, we'll ask Senator Montes Anderson to carry this bill. Okay, and now we will close the work session on SCR 201, open a work session on SB 1567. Senator Winters.
I'm at SB 1567. I move that we do pass 1567 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Winters has moved SB 1567 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Winters, would you like to carry this?
I would be delighted to do so.
For the record, Senator Winters is delighted. So that completes our work committee. Good job. We are adjourned.